This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
They might talk about humor, music, film, books, football and box sets, exercise and maybe even food. Trivia and sport, politics and health, sometimes well-being too. On the Life with Brian. On the Life with Brian.
Here we are again then, the Life with Brian podcast featuring, in ascending order of importance, me, Mark, hello, and Matthew. How do you do, Matthew? How are you going?
I'm good, thank you, Mark. Good to see everyone again.
Fantastic. And of course, Brian Chockey McClare, who, according to the internet at least, was once quite good at football. Is this true, Brian?
No, you know what the internet is like, you know, people can doctor things all over the place. So.
Yeah, that's true. Okay then.
I might change that myself later.
So to our special guest. He's a 2 Michelin star chef from a family of chefing royalty and owns the famous Le Gavroche restaurant in London. He has been on countless TV cooking shows, most notably MasterChef The Professionals. And we believe he's a Manchester United fan. So both he and keen amateur chef Chockey should have plenty to talk about. So a big warm welcome to Michelle Roux. How are you doing, Michelle?
Yeah, fantastic. It's great to be on board and 100% right. Man United fan since 1976. And there's a little story to that, but maybe for later.
Well, yeah, we did want to go into the football chat, but I was going to say we're recording this just a couple of days after France versus England in the World Cup quarterfinal. I don't need to ask Brian this question, but to you, Michelle, truthfully now, who are you reading?
Why are you not asking me?
Because I know who you wanted to win, because you were texting me about 10 minutes after the final whistle.
I didn't know. That's not true.
All right.
That's got to be the old alliance, hasn't it,
Travis? Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Is that your answer?
Well, I mean, that's my answer. But I mean, it's as simple. I mean, you were born in England, although your parents are French.
Yeah.
And you also, I mean, that's one of the kind of things about doing with some research. Did you have to do national service, or did you just...
That's correct. Yeah, I was born in Kent, hence the English accent, and did English schools. But my parents are French. All my family are French. Coming back to the World Cup, for me it was win-win because I support England as well as France. So win-win situation for me.
No.
Yeah.
I'm not having that.
Brian is good.
The national service bit, at the age of 18, I got called up because I have dual nationality.
Right.
So, I had to choose either do my national service and keep dual nationality or not do it and then lose it. As it happens, I did my national service and kept my French nationality. So, which has come in quite handy now.
When you're traveling, join this queue. No queues for you, is there? Yeah. Well, it was just a daft little thing because is it correct that you spent your national service in the kitchen?
Yeah. So I did 3 months training, proper military training. So learning how to fire a gun and to do all the stuff that you need to know if, you know, you're going to be a soldier. And then the following 9 months was actually cooking because I was a qualified chef by then. And I was cooking for the president of France. So because the whole kitchen of the Elysee Palace was run by military. I was very fortunate to end up cooking for 2 presidents, Valéry Giscard d'Estaing and Mitterrand. So it was an amazing experience, absolutely amazing experience.
The thing that kind of popped into my head, and it's no slight on your cooking, but did these presidents have tasters? No, I'm serious, because I know apparently Roman Abramovich had one or two, depending on if they survived or not. I just said it popped into my head that, you know, I don't know. I don't know if this happens to the royal family or certain people, whatever. You've worked in the kitchens. I was just wondering if it just gets passed to someone who makes sure you haven't messed about with it, you know. They just go straight. No. It just went straight there.
It's kind of the job that you would have applied for, isn't it, I think? No. There was no official tasters. I mean, there's a head chef and there's a protocol, like it is at Buckingham Palace. And yeah, we're professional chefs. We're not going to kill anyone.
I was going to ask, Michelle, how and sort of when did football, and specifically Manchester United, come into your life?
Yeah, okay. Well, so I was born in Kent and we moved, the family moved to South London, Tooting to be precise. And my nearest, when I was seven, my nearest professional football club was the Crazy Gang, Wimbledon. I literally lived 10 minutes walk from Plough Lane. So as a young kid, I used to go to Plough Lane and watch watch Wimbledon there, which I must say, as a very, very young teenager, was great fun. And I used to also go to the Speedway, at Wimbledon Speedway on a Wednesday. Sunday was stock cars and bangers, Destruction Derby, which was such great fun. And also the dogs as well, the dogs on a Thursday. So that was my sort of early teens. When I got to the age of 16, this was 1976, on the eve of the cup final, the Edwards family went for dinner at Le Gavroche, so my father's restaurant in town, the night before. Enjoyed the meal so much, they left two tickets for the cup final on the table as a thank you and as a tip. So Dad came back with a ticket. He gave the other ticket to the manager of the restaurant, took one back for me. So as a 16-year-old, I went to the cup final at the old Wembley, to see Man United lose. But I was hooked. I was hooked on Man United and have supported them ever since. And I've gone to big games in Europe, followed them all over. And I get to see most of the London games. And at one stage, I used to go up at least, at the very least, 10 times a season, drive up on a Wednesday night or drive up on a Saturday and go and see a game. And with my daughter as well, we used to have great fun going there. But sadly, I'm so, so bloody busy that I haven't been to Old Trafford now. Well, actually, I was pre-pandemic. So, yeah, 2019 was my last visit. So, yeah, but I still get to see all the London games, which is great.
Some would argue that wasn't a bad time to stop.
Well, to be honest, yeah, there was a period, and I think it was, it was probably the Jose Mourinho era where I really did think, what the hell is going on? You know, this is not the way I love watching Man United play.
Yeah. Well, but, I mean, you're one of many sort of well-known United fans we've had on the show for obvious reasons. But, and I always say this, when you started watching them in 76, you know, you pretty much saw that, the crest of the wave having been promoted, yeah, and then the sort of difficult years in the 80s and then the glory years of the 90s with the likes of Brian, turn things around. So you've pretty much seen a sort of spectrum of United that a lot of modern-day fans probably wouldn't be aware of, but you've pretty much seen it all, I'd say.
Absolutely. I mean, some of them are, yes, you say that the younger United fans came on board maybe in the glory years, the Sir Alex Ferguson years, and they're wondering now what the hell is going on. But if you've been a supporter and following them since, like myself, as I said, 1976, you've been through all that. You've been through the terrible, really, really, really bad years, going down a division and seeing some pretty awful stuff, and then clinging on to little bits of magic, but that's part of supporting the team. Surely you go with the rough and the smooth, and I think the glory years will come back to United. I think personally, I think there's a really good feeling now at the club, and I can see ourselves moving forward.
I mean, that was around about the time you started. You sort of fell for United, Brian, wasn't it? When just after they went down?
Yeah, just at the end of the season when they went down, yeah. From the moment Dennis Lawback healed the ball into the to the game, to the goal in the Derby game, that was, and I was fascinated by it. When we didn't see that much football in Scotland, well, you only saw the highlights, but you'd see the Scottish game first. And often because Manchester United were playing such great football in the second division under Tommy Docherty, you would quite often get a United game. And I just really enjoyed the way that they played football. And it's been the way that, I have always enjoyed football and been fortunate enough to be in teams that I have gone and played that kind of way with risk. If you want to sort of talk about, you know, the first question about the game the other night, I think England could have risked more than they did.
Yeah.
In that, I it comes from Alex Ferguson. Sometimes in the game you have to risk, but if you're going to go out, sometimes I think you should go out with having created a bit more. I know they did create some things, but Aura went with five attacking players. I think when you've got two defensive midfield players, it's... Well, one thing for me always is in any game, you don't trust your central defenders. That's the first thing. You know, they have to have two people in front of them. But I don't see why you can't just have four defenders and one holding midfield player, which probably would have been Rice, and found a way to fit in either Rashford or Grealish into the and a forward. And I think that when you've got clever players, football players, they can go and play and find spaces all over the place, and I think that would cause an awful lot more trouble for the... I can't say that that would have made, that they would have won the game, of course, but I just feel that they're not risk enough. And a lot of that becomes sometimes, if you analyse the coach where they kind of believe that the where the coach and the coach played. I think defenders are negative and I think attackers are positive. And I've yet to be dissuaded from that. You know, if you use Alex Ferguson as a striker and he wanted attacker and he took risks, the next manager to come in was David Moyes, and David was very much about not losing goals. And I think that was the same thing the other night. That I know that for me, they went out with a... Some people say a bang, but for me, it was more of a whimper.
Yeah, I tend to agree there, Brian. I mean, when you've got players as good as Rashford and Grealish, and they were only given a few minutes, I mean, you know, they're players that could have changed the game. And absolutely, if you're going to go out with a bang. You know, get those attacking and players on. And to be honest, they're world class. I mean, England have got world class attackers. That's their strength, you know. So play to your strengths. If the opposition are going to score one, you score one more than them and get on there. And then obviously, Harry Kane missed the penalty, and had he scored that, I think it would have made a huge difference. I mean, France, I think, were getting very anxious at that stage, and it showed. Yeah, who knows? But France are through. I'm happy. Chucky's happy.
I think I know who's happier.
How was your
life? I'm thinking though, Brian, you're born in Scotland, but you lived a lot of your life in England. I mean, in a way, that's almost dual nationality, isn't it?
Yeah, but the thing is, for me, I just want the best team to win games. So if I felt that England... If England had won and deserved to win, then fine, I'm quite happy. I'm sitting and I watched I watched the game in the pub with Cook surrounded by English supporters.
I bet you did.
And I watched the previous game in the pub surrounded by English supporters. Normally, if I was feeling that, but I wouldn't. I'd be sitting in a little cave somewhere with my fingers crossed. But no, I'm prepared. I'm prepared to accept it. You know,
it's a good job there's a lot of pubs in your village.
And I wanted to be, I mean... Everybody's talking about great that the other teams that are in the semi-final, particularly the Moroccans, right? Now, great, I think the way that they've gone, and fantastic to get there. But that game, Portugal and Morocco, that is not a game of football for me. And Portugal had their part to play, or didn't take part to play, whatever it is. But I want to see a game like I saw in the evening with two teams having a go at each other, like France and England. It was unfortunate that they had to meet at that particular point of the competition, because it would have made a great final.
Talking of tactics and all this kind of stuff, Michelle, I mean, were you a player? I mean, we know Gordon Ramsay dabbled in football in his younger days. I mean, were you a player?
Allegedly.
Well, yeah. he likes to think so. But did you?
I played against Gordon Ramsay in the reserves. I played for the Rangers reserves.
Oh yeah. Anything you want to share with us?
I can't remember very much. For probably equally as bad, you know. At the time.
No. I didn't play football at school. I was absolutely useless at football. I played a lot of cricket. And my love was long distance running, athletics. I was one of the kids at school that enjoyed cross country. I've since then, all throughout my life, I've enjoyed running. So I've run loads of marathons. I've run 21 marathons, half marathons, ultra marathons. So for me, that's my moment. That's my way of keeping fit, but also of relieving stress, because it's a moment where I'm on my own. And I can just get out there, and I don't put any music on. I just, it's great for mental health. McClare's on mark.
Yeah, who were your football heroes then, Michelle? Other than Brian, obviously.
Of course. I mean, with a nickname like Chocky.
Chocolate. It's actually short for chocolate, so you should be like,
Exactly.
Chocolate player.
Growing up, it had to be Best. I mean, George Best. My dad, bless him, was a Leeds fan, because back in those days, well, Leeds were up there with the best teams around, and they played a really hard, aggressive football, fast and furious. And Dad absolutely fell in love with that. He loved Billy Bremner. He considered himself the little Billy Bremner of the kitchen. and we used to have a lot of banter about that, about him being a Leeds fan and me being a United fan. But George Best, obviously. I saw him play once live when he was playing for Fulham. Again, when I was a teenager, what a genius, an absolute genius, and a maverick. Going back to the early years, it would have to be George Best, and then during the Sir Alex years, it's got to be Cantona, King Eric. I mean, what a legend, what an inspiration. He inspired the class of 92, you could say, arguably, and what he did at that time, and how Sir Alex got him from Leeds. I mean, it was quite something.
Yeah, your dad must have been pleased then when they left Leeds then, there.
Yeah, but it was a Frenchman, so he was okay. You can have the Frenchman. You can have the mad Frenchman.
He must have thought the same thing that everybody else thought, that he was going to be... sabotage going on, because his reputation in France at the time, you know, that maybe Leeds fans thought, well, we'll send him across to the Manchester to destroy United, you know.
he had a fiery character, and that was well documented, and he was he had loads of arguments with the French Football Federation, and called them a bag of, well, I won't go into the exactly what he called them, but I think that's what the supporters liked about him as well, because he was a character, because he was a, you know, he didn't say no for an answer, and he hated losing. He galvanized the team and made them work harder and made them realize their full potential.
I'm just thinking, a lot of the credit for Cantona's sort of turnaround was down to the manager. And I'm just thinking, do you, in your line of business, are you the sort of person that, you know, with some person, some colleague or employee would have to put an arm around the shoulder, or do you sometimes have to rule with an iron fist like Fergie, and do you have to make that decision of what works best with what person?
Yeah, I think that's the, that has to be Sir Alex Ferguson's greatest asset, and that was his man management. Also, never ever shirking from making tough decisions, and ultimately, if he did make a bad decision, to put his hand up and say, okay, I made a bad decision here. I mean, I'm thinking Jaap Stam, for example, when further on down the line, a year or two later, he said, yeah, I made a mistake there. But he's never shirked from taking those big decisions and I think also getting the best out of every player individually. And as you said, some players needed the arm around, you know, and being treating them in a certain way, and others needed a real rocket, the hairdryer treatment, to get the best out of them. But yeah, I think Sir Alex was a true inspiration for me personally. I mean, I try and emulate him in many ways, and taking the tough, not being afraid of taking tough decisions. And hopefully man management is something as well that you know, I can do as well as him. So some of my staff may need to sit down and have a heart to heart, and others need to have not the hairdryer, but at least stern words. And it is for the good of the team, and it's for the good of the person to get the best out of each person.
With regards to that kind of thing, then, shall we say, you might take someone aside and either praise or give them a bit of practical criticism, but as a kind of message. So Alex Ferguson's hairdryer would be it sometimes at an individual, but he was actually talking to everybody. The message was for everyone. So would you do that occasionally in the kitchen to say, you know, like, say, for example, you're quite exactly the same as Alex Ferguson with regards to time. Now, if Alex Ferguson told you that the meeting was 10 o'clock, what he was saying was, you have to be there at the latest 5 minutes before the meeting.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Right, and I'm not saying he did or he did not, but I think that people who continue to trespass or transgress that those rules and all that kind of thing, careers were curtailed no matter how good they were. Right, so it didn't really matter sometimes about the performances and how well they were playing. I think sometimes they thought, well, no, they just continued to defy him with regards to the timekeeping. So would you do that sort of thing with whatever the reason is to say, well, I'm shouting at you just now, or I'm using stern words for you, but this is for everyone.
Yeah.
You know, there might be occasions where you feel that the whole kitchen's kind of dipped, and they're kind of dipped a little bit with year one, as you've mentioned before, you're a perfectionist, you want to continue perfectionist, you're at the top, and that drives you along. But sometimes people get a bit slack sometimes, maybe depending on what they're doing, or they might be a bit late, or they're not taking care of exactly what they're doing. But the message then is to everyone.
It is. I get that, and there are moments where you blow your top and you say stern words or whatever, and it's aimed at the whole team, and it's another thing as well that you will never, and I never, criticize my team openly or you know, publicly.
Yeah.
And you should, you know, if there is an issue, you deal with it inside, and that is the same, you know, in a kitchen or in a restaurant. And I back my team 100%. And if there is an issue, then you deal with it, and it should be dealt with internally, not, you know, not in front of everybody else. So in many ways there are parallels with, you know, sports and running a successful team, because we work all together. And not, you know, everyone is valued. So be it, you know, the apprentice all the way up to the head chef, or, you know, the front of house, it could be the runners or the plate carriers all the way through to, you know, the sommelier that's taking wine orders for thousands of pounds. Everyone has a very important role to play and a key role to play. And back of house, it could be, you know, the kitchen porters, the ones that clean the pans. You know, to do good cooking, you've got to start with a clean pan. And these guys are, you know, worth their weight in gold. So everyone has a role to play.
And you continue to analyse your team like Ferguson would, to say, well, just imagine, just say that you've got an inkling or an idea, or maybe you should be suggesting that your head chef leaves and starts up his or her own enterprise. And then you're thinking, well, that's the next best in life, actually in your kitchen. Or you might be looking to someone who'd been there before and gone away that you'd worked with, and you liked them and their progress and bring them back. You're always kind of looking to see where, because Ferguson was doing it all the time. Sometimes it's to do with age, sometimes it's to do with whether they felt that the player was had done his time and wasn't hungry anymore. Pardon that parlance. Do you do the same kind of thing with, do you say, well, hold on a minute, you know, you need to be thinking about, he or she needs to be thinking about moving out to do something else, or that you're not good enough, he's giving you enough chances, you have to go. And so do you regularly promote them within the kitchen, if that's promotion, I suppose?
No, it is. Absolutely. And I've always promoted from within. So our head chef, Rachel, for example, she started as an apprentice and has worked all her way up to the very top. She did leave, worked in a different place, a couple of places for 4 or 5 years, and then came back. So I think, you know, that's really important, important too, to keep in contact and to see what's happening outside of your own business, and to bring back people stronger because they've had an experience elsewhere, and they come back with refreshing ideas or different ideas, and that can only be good for you. But age as well is something that is sometimes in our industry, you have to have X amount of years and you have to reach a certain age before a promotion. And I think that's just ridiculous. Yeah. If you're good enough, it doesn't matter what your age. You know, yeah. I've got kids in my kitchen and they are kids. They're still teenagers, but they're doing jobs that normally would go to, you know, 20, 25, 30 year olds, but they're good enough. So why not give them the job and give them that chance and to then promote them as well? And you know, promotion from within is a really, really key tool, I think, in any industry, in any walk of life, because it encourages those people that have got the promotion to work harder and to work up that ladder. But it also means that the people that are at the bottom of the ladder can see that if they stay with you and work hard enough, they too can climb up that ladder. So it's a great, great tool, and it's a great great way to strengthen your business, because the people then that you employ can see that there is many, many chances of doing well in the company, and then they also feel very involved and part of the company. They feel it's part of them because they've traveled, you know, or they've worked their way up and proved their worth. So, you know, I think it's really key to understand every individual that you employ and every individual chef and front of house as well.
Now, since we're talking about cooking, I just wanted to flip it over to you, Brian. I mean, it's among your many talents, you're a bit of a dab hand in the kitchen. Just wonder what your culinary specialities are that you'd feel happy serving up to.
Well, my culinary specialities... Well, I know that I think that the one simple thing, because I've done a little bit of research, I think that I would be able to make a magnificent slice of toast with some fantastic French butter. And I think you'd quite enjoy that, you know, like that. Loads and loads of butter on a couple of bits of really nice, nice bread, you know, nice rustic bread. I'd made the bread, toasted it, and just lashings of French butter. There you go. How's that, sir?
Yeah, you got me on the butter there, Brian. I love my butter, especially quality butter.
You don't like butter, though, Brian, do you?
It's not, I don't.
Feel free to tell the story, why not?
Yeah, well, I think it's when I was a kid, my gran used to make the toast by the fire, and she would put butter on it. That was early years. And then I think the butter must have turned, and... I don't like butter. I knew I like toast, but I don't like butter, you know. So I've never eaten butter. Well, I have in cooking and things like that, but that was for me, you know. So that's why I'm still a finely tuned athlete, because I don't have any butter in my diet, you know. It's just a bit of olive oil, you know.
I'm not sure aware, Michelle, of how Brian got his nickname. We spoke about it earlier in the show. It all alludes to a terrorist shout from years ago, but can you share with us the secret of making a good chocolate eclair stroke McClair?
Yeah, I love eclairs, choux pastry. Now that's one that Brian should definitely put on his repertoire. It's easy to make.
Oh no, I can make that because I'm going to be making some profiteroles for Christmas Day.
Brilliant.
I've got that sorted, yeah. That's on my list to do. Somebody's requested it. Not just me just making it, so, yeah.
So where did this love of cooking come from, Brian? I mean, seriously.
I don't know. It's just I was always encouraged to make sure I could do the basic things in life, you know, cooking, washing, ironing, sewing a button on, change a tyre. that sort of thing. And then, as you get older, I think it's just becomes more of an attraction, you know. And I'm just, and I enjoy messing about. And
a enjoy lot of kids
cooking for people, you know. So
a lot of kids haven't got those skills, have they? I mean, you say change, you know, sewing on a button, the things like that. I mean, just and changing a tire, you know, just basic skills that they've gone.
I'm not sure if my kids can sew any buttons on or change tires either, but I know they can. I know they can cook a bit, so, or they can feed themselves. That's all that matters.
They don't need to. They just give you a call.
Ooh.
Michelle, I took a look through your Twitter account recently, and I saw you posted a picture of Le Gavroche's awful dinner menu. Believe me, I've made a few awful dinners myself. But heart, brain, kidneys, tripe, and all the rest of it. How would you convince awful skeptics like me to take the plunge?
I think if I cooked it, you would love it. I tell you, even tripe. A lot of people say that they don't like tripe, but I cook it in a particular way. It's slow cooked, it goes really tender. It's not strong, and then deep fry it. And as we all know, and Chocky will back me up on this, anything deep fried tastes great.
Yeah, that's correct. I agree with that. Yeah.
Talking of footballers and food, I assume you've had your fair share of footballers dining in your restaurants down the years. Do you have any stories of players opting for beans and chips over the gourmet menu?
Yeah, we've had a lot of footballers come to dine at Le Gavroche over the years. And still now, I mean, a lot of Chelsea guys, because obviously we're not far from Chelsea. And they are very, very good. For the most part, no drinks or only one glass of wine, and they're careful what they choose. You know, so it's great. It's really good. Going back to when David Ginola was playing at Tottenham, he used to come in quite regularly, and he would sometimes even come in maybe the night before a very important game. And let's put it this way, he's French, so he likes his wine and also occasionally a little cigar. So he used to enjoy his pre-match dinner, as it were. And you know what? The next day he'd go out and maybe even score a hat trick or whatever. You would never know. He was an incredible athlete at the time and, yeah, great player.
Sounds like your days, Brian, when the players would go out and get tanked up and play the next day. I mean, I'm not looking at anyone in particular here.
No, they didn't. There was always at least 2 days before that kind of thing where it was a rule in everybody's contract. So they did get to a point where, in away games, Fergie would let you have a glass of wine. That might be to do with Cantona.
So it's all a myth then about players going out the night before a game and then playing the next day?
No, there was none of that, no.
Just at United or generally?
No, in general, I don't think anybody went out the night before.
Oh, I don't know about that, Chucky. There's been some well-documented stories about some players getting completely rat-arsed.
His poker face is fooling nobody there.
No, yeah. Certainly I didn't do that, so...
Oh, maybe we've been unfair. Maybe we're just talking about before your era, maybe, Brian.
I just wanted to ask you, I know it's if you're still using Rooster potatoes.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
My association with Albert Bartlett's goes back for many, many years, and they're friends of the family, and they make some, and they grow some great potatoes.
Yeah, because... Ronnie's cousin was at school, same year as school as me.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, that's just a little thing. Yeah, because where the business is in the Airdrie, where my brother lives.
Ah, I didn't know that.
How's your chutney coming along, Brian, by the way?
Oh, I'll have to dig it out. Yeah, I just noticed it the other day. I think it'll be fine now. I've got raspberry jam, mate.
Yeah, Brian moved to a property recently that's surrounded by raspberry bushes. So any tips you might have what to do with surplus raspberries?
I don't know if he's got raspberries around at this time of the year. It must be finished. But yeah, I mean, if you get a glut of raspberries, they do freeze well. But well, they're jam, in the freezer. Raspberry jam. Yeah.
That's exactly what they are in the freezer.
Have you tried the jam yet?
No, that's the next thing you do is jam. No, at any time, try to do too busy enjoying myself. And doing Amazon shopping.
Raspberry liqueur as well. If you get loads of raspberries, crush them up, a little bit of sugar and some vodka and leave it to steep for about a month.
So it's the return of the quiz. And because we have a footballer who likes cooking and a chef who likes football, we've called this one Braise Your Game. And the rules are simple. I say that every time, and sometimes I do wonder. As usual, it's a penalty shootout format with five alternate questions each. Brian, we're going to give you five names, and you have to tell us whether you think they're French chefs or French footballers.
Oh, brilliant.
So if they're chefs, you have to say filet. And if they're a footballer, say play. And for you, Michelle... And for you, Michelle, you need to tell us whether the following are the first name of Scottish football grounds or one of Glasgow's top 33 restaurants for 2022, according to Time Out magazine. Again, if you think it's a restaurant, say filet. And if it's a football ground, say play. So are you both happy with the rules of the quiz?
Filet and play.
Yeah. We always let our guests go first. So, Michelle, your first one is Stravagan.
Oh, I know the answer to that. So.
Well, of course you'd know the bloody answer. I'm going to go filet.
Yeah, I can't believe it. What a guess. Yes.
Well done, yeah. Filet is a restaurant, and Time Out says it's a hip West End restaurant whose name comes from an old Gaelic word that means to wander aimlessly with intent, which reminds me somewhat of Brian's playing style.
Yeah, I used to do it. I still do it, except it's the streets.
So, Chucky, your chance to level things up. And your first one, you might have to forgive me on these pronunciations because Mark just sent these over to me recently, but it's Paul Bourchoux.
I know that one.
I'm just going to go for filet.
Yes.
Oh, that's me. I'm happy I've got one.
He's a world-renowned Nouvelle Cuisine chef who died poignantly in the same room above his restaurant, Le Auberge du Pont de Colon, in which he was born in 1926. Yeah. So that's 1-1.
Okay, Michelle, it's your second one now, and it's Ockleview. Yeah.
Ockleview. That has to be play.
Oh, he's good.
Two out of two. Yes. Ockleview.
I think you'll find it's Ockleview.
Oh, okay. All right. My pronunciation is not up to scratch.
It's French.
Maybe
it's
my French is better than my Scottish. Okay, yeah, well, Ockleview is the home of Stenhouse Muir for over 130 years. It's also been shared at various times by clubs such as Stirling Albion, Falkirk, and East Stirlingshire.
So, Brian, you're up next, and you get Jean-François Larios.
Larios is a football player. Play.
Yes, I thought that was a little bit easy. He was a midfielder for the celebrated St. Etienne team of the 1970s and 80s and played at the 1982 World Cup. However, he played only two matches after rumours surfaced that he was having an affair with Michel Platini's wife.
No, they weren't rumours.
What a team. Well, as an aside, what a team that was, wasn't it? I mean, the Saint-Étienne team of the 70s. I mean, Rochdeau, Sikes, Maurice Trésor, Platini. What a team that was.
I looked slightly worried there when I mentioned the accusations of that affair.
It got sent home.
Yeah, but to whose home?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know where he went, but I know he left the camp anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So your third one, Michelle, is Capilo.
Capilo has to be a restaurant. Yeah, it has to be filet.
Oh, the first one he's missed.
No!
Yes. Capilou is the home of Greenock Morton. It has stands named the Cowshed and the Wee Dublin End, and the record attendance of 23,500 was for a league deciding match against Celtic in 1922, which Celtic won, and the match ended in a riot which caused damage to Capilou and the surrounding area.
You wouldn't be able to tell. What was it, about £5 worth of damage or something like that? Yeah?
£20,000 worth of improvements.
So this gives Brian the chance to take the lead, which is something of a rarity in these quizzes because he's usually playing catch-up. And it's Joe Rubicon.
Philly.
Yes, named Chef of the Century by a French culinary guide in 1989, and his restaurants have 32 Michelin stars between them, the most any restaurateur has ever held, and he died in 2018.
Matthew, I like the way you swerved the name of the French culinary guide there. Well done.
The thing is, Mike, you've written them in green and I can't see them against the right background.
Oh, right. Okay. All right. It's your eyesight. Yeah, yeah. Whatever. Okay. Michelle, your penultimate one is Ardna Merkin.
Oh, these questions are tough, you know?
No.
I'll say play.
Oh,
oh dear.
It's Filet. Oh,
it's Filet. Oh.
It's in Glasgow.
Well, yeah. It's on Hope Street near the Theatre Royal. Co-owner's family hail from the Ardna Merkin Peninsula in Argyll. And I've been there for dinner and drinks and can recommend.
Was Brian outside trying to get in, was he?
I was sitting there with my little heart.
Okay, this is to make it 4-2 and seal the victory. I think it is, isn't it? Yep.
Yeah.
And it's Jean-Pierre Adams.
Jean-Pierre Adams. Filet.
Oh, failed. Failed to take the quiz. It's play. He's a player. It's a sad story, actually. He formed a sad centre-back partnership for the French national team with Marius Trésor in the early 70s, called Le Garde Noir, the Black Guard. But he underwent knee surgery in 1982, and due to some malpractice in the operating room, he slipped into a coma for 39 years, from which he never came out, and he died in 2021.
Oh.
So we're all tied up with one question to go.
No, I can't. No, I can't.
And you can draw it.
I can't lose. Thank you.
Give me a draw.
Right. Okay. To wrap up your questions, Michelle, and at least don't give Chucky the opportunity to at least claim that he's won one for once. You've got Almond Vale.
I'm going to say play.
Yes. Almond Vale is the home of Livingston since 1995, which through a sponsorship deal with an Italian restaurant chain is known as the Tony Macaroni Stadium, or to mocking opposition fans as the Spaghetti Had.
Just a point of order before we can ask this last question. You're supposed to be Team McClare, both of you.
No, we're not on anyone's side here. We're just reading the questions out.
Are you cheating?
No. There's no scuffing of the penalty spot going on here.
Right, go.
So the final question, Brian, and you got Philip Etchebest.
Philly.
Yes. He's finally won one. He's a top French chef who's appeared on numerous TV programs, the latest being a French language version of Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares.
Oh, swerving the French again there, Matthew.
Yay.
So I make that a 3-2 win for Mr. McClare.
Well done, Chucky.
Thank you very much. Yeah. So let's say, how many is that? I think that the other questions were a bit trickier, really, in the sense that, I mean, I think Michelle's questions were harder than mine.
Well, I could answer all of yours.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. I can answer all of yours. Is it?
McClare's mailbag.
Hot and fresh out of the kitchen, what have the listeners cooked up for Brian and Michelle, please, Matthew?
Okay, Iron Stewart has sent in a good one for you, Michelle. If you had a food van at a football match, what kind of food would you serve? Maybe that should be what kind of food would you think the average punter at a football match would be happy to be served by a Michelin star chef?
Yeah, well, I would say croque monsieur, you know, the famous cheese and ham sandwich that the French do so well. But then I could maybe pimp it up and do different versions, do a Scottish version, maybe with haggis inside. So like a cheese toasty with haggis. Obviously, the Moroccan one, where we're looking at Morocco playing football, we could have maybe a tagine-flavoured toasty. French one would be the famous croque monsieur, obviously. And it's, so you could play around with different flavours.
What was your tipple on the terraces at Parkhead in the old days, Brian? Pies?
This is a choice. A Scottish pie, bits of mutton, a wagon wheel, and Bovril. And that was it.
Can you still get wagon wheels?
Yeah, I think so. They're a lot smaller, like everything else.
If
I went to any football now, I would welcome a Bovril. They still do it in lots of places, lots of places, the pie. But they maybe do something more exotic now, like a cup of tea.
And this actually brings us on nicely to our next question from Martin Lee. And he asked you both, what are the best and worst things you've eaten at a football match? He mentioned a grilled Marquez in Marseille.
Yeah. That was great. You know, beautiful Marquez sausage, which is lamb and harissa in it. So it's quite spicy. Yeah, so just grilled like that. And then a baguette that's lovely and crisp on the outside. That was delicious. Really delicious.
Maybe you could deep fry the wagon wheel. That might add some artistry to it.
I mean, we're talking about the things you like, but what about the worst things you've ever eaten at a football game?
You're just thankful for anything. Yeah. You're growing up in Scotland in the 70s, you know. So there wouldn't be anything that would be bad. Unless somebody gave me a big slice of toast rather than butter.
Without butter.
Yeah. I could eat it then and I'd be hungry.
What about you, Michelle? Anything stand out to you when it comes to the worst things you've eaten at a match?
I've gone to lots and lots of different stadia, had hospitality, which was always good. But I tend to gravitate towards, you know, getting a bite to eat in the stands or outside of the stadium, if I'm going with the lads. But one particular incident at Old Trafford, I was with my wife and we sat down. It was a game against Tottenham, and the guy behind me was maybe a little bit under the weather, or maybe he'd had a few too many pints. I don't know. He had a Trafford pie and he was just sitting down. And just as he took a big bite, it exploded and went all the way down the back of my dear wife.
I bet it was red hot as well, wasn't it?
It was red hot. And of course, he was being very kind. So he rolled up his sleeve and he went, "Don't mind, love, I'll just rub it off." And if my memory serves me right, we lost as well. So that wasn't good.
And last but by no means least, it's Cumbrian Dave.
Michelle, which is the most important piece of culinary advice your father gave you?
Probably take notes and never take anything for granted. So, you know, when you see something new or just write it down and take notes. And then you can refer back to those all the time. So, you know, I've got, it's not a diary, but I've got loads and loads of notes that I've taken down. And I think that's super important.
And you're a learned man, Brian. Is taking notes something you would have done back in the day or even now?
You have to, yeah. You've got to, whatever you're, I mean, I would, the only thing I wouldn't do is take notes during the game.
You see that now, though, don't you? You see subs coming on and handing notes to each other, and you think, what's that all about?
Roy Keane was writing stuff down when Harry Kane scored, didn't he?
I mean, I think that's just because he didn't want to be seen celebrating.
I used to get sent out by Fergie when I was sub to try and pass a message on. It was just preposterous, you know. So you know, me shouting, no, I trying to shout to someone on the pitch, and I got told several times by the assistant referee to sit down, you know.
You're not coming on, so sit back down.
Stop pretending to warm up, you know.
The ping of McLaren's microwave. That's given me an idea for a new section in the podcast. Anyway, that means that we are done for this episode. Michelle, thank you so much for sparing us your valuable time to join us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No problem. Great to talk to you guys. Thanks. Good to see you,
Michelle. Thank you.
Brian and Matthew, thanks as always. I hope you've both been suitably inspired by Michelle to knock something tasty up for our next get-together.
Well, this could be the end of my breakfast in a tin, Brian.
I don't think so.
Brian's disgusted that I've been known to eat an all-day breakfast out of a tin.
Hold on a sec. Everybody's disgusted by it, even people in Scotland.
And, of course, a big thanks to you out there for listening. Please hit subscribe on your preferred podcast provider to get Life with Brian on your device when each new episode drops, as the kids say. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Brian McLaren Pod. Don't forget, we are now part of the Sports Social Podcast Network. So check out the plethora of pods in the stable at sport-social.co.uk and at The Sports Social on Twitter. We'll be back again soon. So until then, take care of yourselves.
Life with Brian, talking films or music. Life with Brian, talking TV and food. Life with Brian, talking trivia and exercise. Life with Brian, it's different every episode. Life with Brian, talking politics and football. Life with Brian, it's different every episode. Life with Brian, Life with Brian.
Sports Social Podcast Network.